This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For a state whose wine industry is still recovering from the Prohibition era, North Carolina has a large cult of high-end fine wine collectors, and we are host to the largest fine wine auction in the southeastern mid-Atlantic states. That auction is scheduled for just 3 days from now, so just in case you want to go and bid, we thought we'd squeeze in a little education beforehand. We've enlisted the help of some experts for this, among them Mark Solomon, the fine wine director at Leland Little Auctions in Hillsborough. By the way, if you know nothing about fine wine or about wine at all but would like to, take heart. Mark went from being a neuropsychologist for whom wine was either red or white to his position today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you. Jerry Dulliner is cellar master for the North Carolina chapter of the Commanderie de Bordeaux, Aux États-Unis d'Amérique. I haven't spoken French since high school. You'll have to forgive me. Which was started in 1959 by a small group of lovers of Bordeaux wine and has grown to include 30 chapters in different cities around the country. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here.
And Jay Murray is with us. He is managing partner of Piedmont Wine Imports, a wine wholesaling company. He started drinking wine as a UNC undergraduate because he liked buying by the case to get the discount. He started selling wine because he realized people got paid to taste it and to travel to wine estates near and far. And this morning he's traveled to our wine estate because when I walked in the door, you've already opened bottles and poured tasting samples, and it smells like a winery in here. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, it does.
That's a good thing, I suppose. I mentioned in the opening minute, which we don't hear in the studio, that not only is the state home to the largest fine wine auction in the southeast and mid-Atlantic states, it is home to a cult of high-end fine wine collectors. How did that come to be? Why is that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a really we're fortunate to live in North Carolina in areas like Charlotte and the Triangle because of the area of size it is. There's a disproportionate amount of wine drinkers and foodies that live here. And there's a lot of reasons. I think there's a lot of people who move here. I think there's a lot of industry here, a lot of high tech here, a lot of people who just like to learn new things. And I think that is a lot of reason why there's a large, passionate wine drinking community.
How much of it has to do with the fact that there's a lot of money here? Because
well,
if you're collecting fine wines, that doesn't hurt, does it?
I think you're right. Absolutely.
You know, over the weekend, Charlotte was it was revealed that Charlotte, this region, is the 16th largest city in the country now, and Raleigh and Charlotte are two of the fastest growing cities in the country now. So they may help you as you go forward here. Is that why this wine auction is located in this part of the country, because of this interest in wine and because of the what you just talked about?
Well, excellent question. And so the way the wine auction started is that before, in order to acquire some of the more rarer bottles, one had to go to New York City or had to go to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And there seemed to be a real need for a wine auction here. So people locally in North Carolina or even Atlanta or Georgia could go to a place and just not have to travel so far to do this. And that's really the concept that kind of drove this. And we've been doing this for, I would say, 4 years now, and it's really grown, and we have people who come from all over the state to attend the auction, and we have people who've been around and have collected for many years. We also have new people, too, who know very little about wine but really want to learn.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Who comes to these wine auctions? Because if you go to a wine auction, if you go to any auction, you probably should be an expert to know what you're buying, if, in fact, you bid, but can ordinary people come? Do ordinary people come? Do novices come?
Absolutely. Novices do come. And, you know, when we say fine wine, we're not talking, you know, not all bottles are going into the stratosphere in price. We're talking about wines that can go from $20, $30 a bottle. And these are people who really want to jump in with both feet and really want to try a variety of wine that's been proven and people know that it tastes good.
But if you're new, let me ask you about that. If you go to an auction, can you assume, is it safe to assume that all of the wine is going to be good wine?
Well, you know, it's safe to assume that the wine has been vetted for sure, because, you know, when you get into older wines, mm-hmm. sometimes it's hard to ensure that all the quality is there.
Well, because it's been cellared for so long, right?
That's right. And, you know, sometimes wine just naturally goes bad over time. Right. Corks can fail, and there's just a lot of things involved that...
Go ahead.
So one thing about the wine auction is you have the ability to buy wines that are ready to drink. Most wine in the United States is purchased and consumed within 3 hours. The wine that people are buying at auction is better wine. It requires 3 years, 10 years, 20 years of cellaring. So you can't find those in a wine shop. So where you find mature wines is at an auction.
So at the auction, you have an opportunity to go and look at the actual bottles you'll be bidding on? Because I've read stories of people going to auctions, looking at the fill levels and making sure the cork hasn't – there's no leakage around the top of the bottle.
Well, you absolutely know your stuff. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, when you go to a wine auction, it's very important to inspect the bottles and to, you know, to see what you're getting. And I try to – if there's any issues with the bottle conditions, I usually try to, remove them from the auction, and I try to put only the best bottles in. And,
so Jerry just maligned new wine, Jay, and you're a wine importer.
He's correct that people drink wine right after they buy it, and a lot of times that's great. I mean, a lot of times that's what the wine is intended for. So not all wines need to be buried under your house for 15 years.
So it's okay to drink the Beaujolais Nouveau.
Yeah, or even like you know, a lot of wines are young and fresh and lively, and that's their appeal. And you know, I think that's not to sell those products. I mean, there are things that. That youthfulness is an asset. There are other types of wine that are kind of hard and unapproachable and muted when they're young, and those things do, you know, require someone's cellar.
How do you learn this? This seems like this is one of the problems, I think, with wine, which is so intimidating, because part of it is this effete kind of image, but it's not really. It's just that you have to know a lot.
Yeah, and it's not reducible to, like, you can't read a book that's going to, you know, I don't believe in any of that sort of, like, dummy's guide to wine mm-hmm. or, like, in 270 pages, I'm going to teach you everything you need to know about wine. That the appeal of wine is that it's vast and that it's complicated and interesting, and it's a lifetime of interesting stuff. So
when you buy a relatively new vintage of what should be a good wine, how do you know how long to not open it, to cellar it before you enjoy it?
I think that the first thing you need to do is start a relationship with a merchant that you trust. You in your community, there's probably an independent wine shop that has a person in it that is mildly obsessed with wine. Get to know that person. If you share their tastes, trust their opinion. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you have to try a lot of bottles to pick up that sort of nuanced knowledge of save this for 5 years or save this for 10 years. You know, good reference books can get you part of the way there, but I think.
Well, does it depend on the whether it's a Cabernet or a Merlot or a Pinot Noir, or does it depend on who made the wine? What are the factors?
Yes.
All of those.
The human imprint is certainly there. There are some winemakers that are making things for farther down the road than others. The grape variety certainly matters, like the thickness of the skins of the grape and the amount of tannin imparted. You know, the climate of the place certainly matters. It's all those things piled up, and which is why it's not a simple topic.
Now, I know that, Mark, you said that some of these wines at auction, fine wines, can go for $20, $30, $40 a bottle as opposed to thousands. And some of these bottles of wine have literally gone for thousands of dollars in some of these places. So how do you know when to open the really expensive? If you have the funding to to buy a $3,000
right.
bottle or a $10,000 bottle of wine.
To be clear, to open up a $3,000 bottle of wine, I'm not opening it. So someone else is, and they're sharing it with me.
I mean, none of these bottles of wine on the desk here are $3,000 bottles?
Well,
get out of here.
No, it would take a pallet to get $3,000 out of these wines. But the thing about wine is over the last 10 years or so, wine making has changed a bit in that most wines, especially from California, are drinkable on release.
Is that a good thing?
Well, yeah, for the wineries, because then people run out of it and have to buy more.
So if they're drinkable on release, can you put it in the cellar for 5 years?
Sure, some of them would age better than others. You know, wine is really just a beverage, and it's an agricultural product. So every year, even from the same producer, same area, it's going to be different. Like in North Carolina, one year your tomatoes do better than the eggplant or the okra does better. And the same thing, if you're only growing grapes and you have a particular weather pattern for the growing season that stinks for grapes, the wine's not going to be that good. Mm. At the highest level of wine production, they can do things in the vineyard to make it better. And then the average and below average wine producers are going to have diluted wine or green or not ripe or something like that.
And that's the other thing you hear a lot of talk about, the actual person, the wine, or I can't think of the guy's name, the guy who actually does the wine.
Winemaker.
The winemaker, thank you. How simple was that? But because a lot of times he blends certain kinds of grapes, and just because it's sold from a certain winery doesn't mean that they grew the grapes. They can buy grapes from other places and blend them.
Yeah, so my company only deals with estate bottled wines to sort of get around that issue because, you know, vintage to vintage, I at least know that the farmer who makes the wine that I sell controls the process. You can make very good wine buying wine from other people or buying grapes from other people and assembling it. That's cool, but that's not what Piedmont Wine Imports is into. And partly because, like, as a merchant, I like to go out there and know that, like, there is at least that constant. The raw materials are of the same fields, of the same place. And
so you can compare apples to apples.
Yeah, exactly.
Year to year.
And and kind of geek out on that. I mean, a lot of, like, where I am in terms of learning about wine, and I think we're all still at points on a continuum, like learning what we don't know about wine, really, is that I want to see, like, this particular person, the wine they're making today compared to the wine they made 10 years ago and 10 years into the future, like learning that continuum is exciting to me, and it's building upon what I do.
So let's define fine wine. Yeah. What are we talking about? What is it? And what makes it different from Two Buck Chuck?
So, you know, can I dive into this one first?
Sure.
I think that the majority of wine that people run into is it's a commodity. It's like the kind of orange cheese that you buy in the grocery store that's in the block. And there's nothing inherently wrong with it, but you're not looking for, like, a revelatory experience from it. You're looking for it's a base food product because, you know, wine is just a food product.
Right.
There are some people out there that still use agriculture to express traditions from their culture, from their past, and the products are maybe a little bit more alive and a little bit more exciting to us. To me, that's fine wine, or to me, that's, like, interesting wine, at least. Maybe the term fine wine is not useful so much as, like, characterful wine or evocative wine and, you know, maybe more industrial or homogenized wine. And the problem is, on the label, it's very hard to get at which is one and which is the other, because folks who produce sort of mass market wine have the ability to make a label that has, like, a pretty house on it and some vineyards, and you think, like, oh, this comes from a place, and perhaps it comes from an oil tanker instead.
I also read that some of the hottest selling wines in the country have little cuddly animals on the label.
Sure.
All that critter wine.
Yeah. That's right. Well, you, Mark, said that the difference between average wine and fine wine has to do with what he just talked about. Jay just talked about taste.
Sure.
Also price point and possibly more finely tuned production methods. Hold your thought. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about those three things. And then, since you've opened three bottles of wine, I think it would be a sin not to taste them. So we'll talk about what we're tasting and how you go about tasting a fine wine. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and New Dominion Bank, a local community bank focused on building relationships. More information available at newdominionbank.com. And the Downtown Hickory Farmers Market, fresh produce, meats, dairy, baked goods, artisans, and more, Wednesdays and Saturdays, now through October, on the square in downtown Hickory. Details at hickoryfarmersmarket.com. Well, perhaps you've heard, the Bobcats are no more. The buzz is back. The Hornets' name has returned to Charlotte's NBA team, and executives with the team are hoping that the rebirth of the original name, along with some aggressive moves in the front office and on the court, we'll get the hive buzzing again. To that end, they're launching a rebranding campaign. We'll talk about how you rebrand a team and what is the difference in a name tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama this week will outline a strategy for defeating the extremist group ISIS, analysis of U.S. options, and what support the president can expect from Congress and the American people.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, where 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are talking about wine this morning, fine wine particularly, and we'll get into how to taste it and how to tell the difference between a fine wine and an ordinary wine in a moment. We're doing all this in advance of one of the largest wine auctions in the country, which happens every year here in North Carolina, thanks to Mark Solomon, who's the fine wine director of Leland Little Auctions. Jerry Dolaner's with us. He's the cellar master for the North Carolina chapter of the Commanderie de Bordeaux. Bordeaux, which we will talk about. We'll talk about Bordeaux wines. And Jay Murray, managing partner of Piedmont Wine Imports. Mark, where is this auction? We should talk about that first, I think.
The auction is in Hillsborough, which is sort of next to Durham and Chapel Hill.
Okay. And ordinary people go. And when is it? It's Thursday or Friday?
It's Thursday night.
Thursday night.
And normal people go. And it's actually a fun time. I mean, it's like a real auction. You hold up paddles and you the bidding, the auctioneer shouts out the prices, and but not fast, so fast that you can't understand what he's saying.
And how do you know how much to pay for one? How do you know when to stop?
Well, there are auction databases, like True Bottle is one, where you can go on and you can see what wines with certain vintages have gone for in the past.
And as you said in the last segment, some of these fine wines are $20 a bottle, $30 a bottle, $50 a bottle.
Not so many.
You'll
find
you
at that find price it. Point. But I go to the auction almost every quarter because I it's fun.
How do you
the
drink all this?
We don't drink at the that much, but at 5 o'clock there is a reception.
Uh-huh.
And most successful charity auctions start with imbibing to loosen up the crowd, and I think that's why they do that also. And there's our appetizers, and
right.
Then you sit down at 6 o'clock and the bidding starts. It's quite a lot of fun.
So we were talking just prior to the break about the difference between fine wine and ordinary wine, and you say, Mark, I mean, Jay just said that you talked about the flavor profile and all the different flavors, the interesting flavors that you can detect in a fine wine that perhaps are not there in a lesser wine. You say it's taste, price point, and finely tuned production methods.
Well, and Jay is absolutely right. I mean, the complexity of a wine can absolutely, absolutely determine, whether it's, quote, fine wine or not, and the production methods as well. But when you get down to it, of course, fine wine is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
And I think is fine wine might not be what someone else likes. But, the beauty of it is that it's such a learning process to learn what is fine wine to you. What is that you like? And it's just fun to go from grape to grape to from region to region and to kind of go on that journey. And that journey just – it doesn't end.
Is the rule of thumb to buy and drink what you like, whether or not it is a fine wine?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that the most of what I think – good wine, in my opinion, is made in the way that you imagine wine being made in your head, like a small group of people with a vineyard, like a tractor.
I see Lucy stomping grapes.
Okay, yeah. that works too. I think that's actually a perfectly valid method of production. But so to me, what people are imagining as good, real wine is actually what it is. It's just that not all wine is like that. And so connecting to that simple, by hand, human scale winemaking is really what the journey to interesting wine is.
How much of the price of a bottle of wine, particularly a fine wine, when you're talking about in the hundreds to thousands of dollars, has to do with the quality of the wine versus its rarity or scarcity or the trendiness of that particular bottle?
It's just, that's such an excellent a question because, you know, in some cases, when you're talking about wine, you do get what you pay for. That you know, the more you spend, generally, you're going to get a better quality wine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that happens to a point. Whereas, you know, it's hard to say that a $500 bottle of wine is going to be significantly better than a $100 bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at that point, you are definitely talking about economic factors, the factors of having a special bottle on your shelf, and, you know, the impressive factor and things like that.
There are commonly accepted standards. Like, people recognize that certain producers or certain regions are, like, on average better than others. But when you get to the real fine end of that, it's often scarcity.
Are there American-made fine wines? Because California, we are told, has eclipsed France as a wine-producing region, and their wines seem to be thought of around the world as good as those.
Yeah, there's definitely the equivalent of first-growth wines in California wineries, some brand new and some of them older, that are considered the top tier, and they fetch astronomical prices.
Name some labels in California.
Screaming Eagle, Harlan, Mayacamas. This is an older one. Rubicon from Francis Ford Coppola's winery.
Really? I was just going to bring his name up.
Right. So he bought one of the most historic wineries in California that was originally founded in the 1840s.
Wow.
And he sells mass market wines for $10, and he sells wine for $150.
Are there any in North Carolina? Because we're a wine producing state now too.
Funny you should ask.
Yes.
We have two North Carolina wines that we brought with us today.
Okay.
These are both Vinifera wines rather than the Muscadine. Muscadine vines grow east of I-85 more or less, and the fine wines of Noble grapes grow in the west. And so we brought some wine to taste.
Okay. We'll get to that in a second. The Edinburgh International Science Festival, in a blind taste test with more than 570 people, served a range of cheap and expensive wines, and only 50% of the people there could identify the better wines from the cheap wines. So that begs the question, why all the fuss? If you can't tell the difference, maybe you shouldn't be there, perhaps. But the other question is, maybe you can't tell the difference. You can't tell the difference, buy the cheap stuff, right?
Yeah, I don't necessarily – I don't say I don't believe that, but like I think that in a – you know, tasting one bottle of wine by itself – you know, sometimes, you know, you can trick people and like, I poured you an $8 glass of wine or $8 bottle of wine and it's, you thought it was more expensive. But in my experience, if you put a very high quality wine in a glass next to a very low quality wine, everybody in the room or most people in the room can taste the difference. So those, I hear these stories apocryphally a fair amount and it does not sync with my life experience. So
it's not just taste. It's not just the flavor profile. It is also the feel of it in your mouth.
Yes.
That's right.
It's what it smells like.
That's right. And it's the company you're drinking the wine with and what you're eating the food with and the day you're drinking the wine. And you could have the same wine and with the same vintage, and every bottle from that wine and vintage could taste a little bit different.
Huh.
And they might, depending on storage conditions or what barrel it came from.
And I've had I'm sure you have too. I've had the experience where you open a bottle of wine, you let it breathe, you do all the right things.
Right.
You sip it, and you just don't like it very much. And then you have food with it, and it's fine.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So how can you tell what it's going to be like? Well, how do you know what to open when? I guess that's the question.
Yeah. Well, what I do if I'm buying wine, I usually, like we said earlier, most people consume their wine within hours of purchase. So if you're buying better wine, and my definition of fine wine, the difference between fine wine and ordinary would probably be about $40. Maybe that might be the separation for fine.
$40 a bottle.
Yeah,
okay.
Or $40 difference between a $10 and a $50. I mean,
okay,
you should be
right.
able to
gotcha.
Taste that difference. But I lost my train of thought on that one.
Well, we were talking about how do you pair, how do you know when to open
Oh, if you're going to buy finer wine, you buy more than one bottle, buy maybe four or six. You drink one bottle right when you buy it,
mm-hmm.
kind of get an idea of its youthfulness and strength and if it's going to age, and then put it in your wine cellar, put it on the database to try it again in a year or 2 years or 5 years.
Now, I want to tell all three of your stories because all three of your stories are different. But first, let's taste some of this wine because, and let's talk about how you taste it because you hear people talking about the nose. You hear people talking about the mouthfeel, the legs on the glass as the wine goes back into the glass after you sip it. Is all that important?
I don't think that the legs are all that important. This is maybe like my my dissonant moment from the wine community, but like that's like generally sort of a measure of alcohol by volume. And in the era of like climate change and like modern winemaking technology, I'm not too concerned if my wine is 11.5% alcohol or 13.5% alcohol.
Right. Like because the legs are an indication of how much alcohol is.
Exactly. Like that's not a it's not a key indicator of quality for me personally. Now, you know, if you're looking for a higher alcohol wine, then maybe it is. So.
Well, let's start from the beginning. Let's go over some basics, unless you want to jump in here.
Oh, what I was just going to say is that to me, more importantly, is when I taste wine, I try to – the more important aspect is to taste wine in the same way each time. And that way, when you have a routine, mm-hmm. then you know when any differences you're tasting in the wine are due to the wine itself and not in the order you're doing things.
So what's the same way that – what's the way you do it?
Well, people do it differently. But sometimes – and I know Jerry has a wine that he's opened up. And sometimes people will look at the color first and then do and then go to smell and things like that. But
and when we talk about things like that, are we talking about exclusively red wine or we also talk – do these things apply to white wine?
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, white wine usually doesn't have as much of an aroma to it.
Okay.
Pink wine, too.
Let's begin with some basics. How should you store a wine if you're going to cellar it for a while? Where should you put it? What should the temperature be? How important is that? Do you really have to go in there every once in a while and just rotate the bottles?
No. Don't want to do that. You want to keep it – if you don't have a proper wine cellar with a temperature control
– right.
Needs to be on its side to keep the cork wet, needs to be in the dark, needs to be vibration-free. So not in the kitchen, not above the stove on the little diamond-shaped rack that they put in there. But you want to keep it in a closet, maybe in a spare bedroom, maybe in the basement. And, 60 degrees is fine as long as the temperature doesn't vary up and down a lot. It can be a little warmer.
Well, most people don't keep their homes at 60 degrees. So if you don't have a wine cellar and you're putting it in
closet.
But if you're putting it in the closet and it's 72, is that going to kill the wine?
It just will age
or
quicker.
75.
75 is not good.
Okay.
It will just age quicker and last shorter.
Shorter. And how do you know when it has aged?
Well, I think that you mentioned earlier buy four bottles or six bottles. And the fun of all this is drinking. So like the reason why people used to buy wines by the case was so that every 6 months or a year you could check in with the wine and have friends over and open a lot of bottles. But I think the thing is like it's really fun and interesting to pull corks. And I would say for each person, like a perfectly mature bottle is at a different point in its lifespan. So okay. I might like my wine younger than you do. So.
And how long should you wait? Because you talk about buying it and consuming it within 3 minutes of buying it. How long should you wait to open
Wait too long, it will all be vinegar. So,
But some people buy these wines from the 1700s. Is that just because they want to have the bottle?
That's more of an investment than a
But if it's an investment, it's an investment in what? If it's already vinegar, what's it an investment in, the label?
Well, some wines do age for very long times. Italian wines like Barolos can age for years, and Bordeaux and Burgundies. And what ages the most are called fortified wines, wines like port dessert wines. They can age for a really long time because of high sugar content.
And are white wines meant to be consumed quickly?
Not all of them.
Yeah, I think a lot of German Rieslings age very well. A lot of white Chardonnays from Burgundy age very well. And I've had many happy experiences with 15, 20-year-old bottles of Italian white wine. So.
Now, they say that wine needs to breathe once you open it before you drink it. And this wine has been sitting out here for at least 40 minutes breathing. I guess that's what it's doing. Is it breathing? Is that what it's doing? I don't hear it, but
Yeah, it's aerating. So this wine, this first one, none of these are expensive wines. The first one is a 2006 Chalk Hill Chardonnay from Sonoma County, California. When we poured it, it was not quite this dark red. It was more bricky color.
It's a what now? What did you call it?
It's a Chalk Hill is the area. It's right. A Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay, I thought you said Chardonnay. I thought
from Sonoma County. So it's sitting in a nice big glass. Those of you at home with a glass of wine in your hand can
at 9:36
can come along with us. So there's something called the five S's. Sometimes it's six S's, like the letter S. So what you do is you put wine in a glass and you see it. You just look at it, check out the color, check the clarity, the viscosity. Just look at it. Then you swirl. You swirl it in the in the glass, hopefully without spilling it. That's going to aerate it. So this bottle of wine has been closed up tight like a genie in a bottle for however many years. So you want to get some air back into it. They've taken great pains to have no air in there because that could spoil it. So you get the air in there. So you're swirling it. Then you sniff it.
And what are you smelling for? This is
the smelling for any defects, you know, like any kind of musty smell or some off smells. And then you're just smelling. Sir, each grape varietal has a basic profile that you're looking for, the dark fruit or light fruit. And you hear all these descriptive adjectives, which my palate cannot translate what I smell into words very well, not like a wine critic, a professional. But you know, does it smell like cherries or does it smell like apricots or does it smell like mint or any of these?
And why would it smell like cherries or apricots when it, in fact, is a grape? But it does. You can taste it. You can taste chocolate. You can taste plum. Yeah. Why does it do that?
Well, and so there's a concept in wine that's been used a lot called terroir, that there's a lot that goes into what causes a wine to taste like it does. And it could be, you could have the same grape grown in a different area and the wine will taste completely different. It's because you're using different soil and the seasons are different and you have different, it rains at different times.
And the vineyard faces the sun at a different angle.
And so you can, all this can add different flavors to the wine.
Yeah, that's why wine is a more evocative food product. It's more akin to cheese than anything else I can think of. But like, it's not just, you're not just tasting grape juice in the glass. Or
now I just want to point out that we have three bottles open. How do I know what is in my hand
here? Because I told you.
Okay.
This one.
You kept track of it.
Yes, this one. So anyway, so we're up to swirl. We're up to sniff.
Okay.
Then you sip. Put it in your mouth, swish it around like mouthwash, get it onto all the different components of your tongue that has different flavor, what do they call those things, your flavor receptors. And then the last S is either spit, which Mike did not do, or swallow. So depending on how much you're drinking and what time and what your next commitment is, you can either swallow or spit.
Well, we'll be spitting the rest of it because it's illegal to drink on the radio.
Oh, yeah, we're not drinking on the radio.
I spit, I saw
that. Anyway, so then you want to take the other wine that we have in the glass. So we have and look at them side by side. You'll see the second one is much less dense.
Yeah, it's lighter.
Very much lighter color.
Mm-hmm. And this is what?
This is the Childress Vineyards 3.
Okay.
So coming to downtown Charlotte, we thought it prudent to have a Childress wine with Dale Earnhardt's car number on it, which is what this is, and this is non-vintage.
We'll walk down to the NASCAR Hall of Fame to drink this.
This is one of the largest and oldest wineries in North Carolina.
Okay, before we drink, we'll take a break. And we're going to come back and talk more about fine wine and how to taste it, how to determine what it is, and how these guys got started in this, because their stories are individual and they're really interesting. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fox 46 WJZY. Each morning, Good Day Carolina serves a healthy plate of positive information to help start the day. Fox 46 Carolinas, WJZY. And the Bilo Supermarket, serving the Southeast for over 50 years. Bilo offers bonus fuel perks items with the Bilo Bonus Card. Store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks program details at buy-low.com. President Obama this week will outline a strategy for defeating the extremist group ISIS, analysis of U.S. options and what support the president can expect from Congress and the American public, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. By the way, our guest today, Mark Solomon, has shared his picks for the best restaurant wine lists from across the state, and you can find that on our food blog, WFAEats.org. You can also join our conversation by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or join us on search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Which are you, a morning person or a night owl? Here's why I ask.
People can be ethical at one point in time and unethical at another point in time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Chronotypes, what they are and why they matter. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about wine, fine wine, in advance of one of the largest auctions in the country, which will be Thursday evening in Hillsboro. Mark Solomon is fine wine director of Leland Little Auctions. Jerry Dulliner is the cellar master for the North Carolina chapter of the Commanderie de Bordeaux. And Jay Murray is managing partner of Piedmont Wine Imports. They brought several wines to taste. None of them are terribly expensive wines. Rats. But let's talk about the Childress number three wine here.
So to me, this is pretty typical of a North Carolina red wine. It happens to be non-vintage.
And it has a completely different smell than the previous
one. Yeah, and the color. We don't know what the grapes are because it doesn't say on the label. It just says red table.
Why wouldn't it?
Well,
my theory was that it's maybe grapes that don't have a lot of market cachet. So I could be completely wrong, but like if they're using esoteric varietals, and, or maybe the blend changes every year, but they want to have a consistent brand. So
tell me what you're tasting here as you taste these two wines. Compare the tastes of. I mean, and I guess you can be critical. So that's what you're here for.
The first wine to me had like an herbal kind of green note up front. There was a little bit more going on in the vegetal family of flavors than in the fruit family.
It's a good wine, I think, and especially for, you know, it's a very good value, and it has a tightness to it.
Yep.
That, you know, could open up over a while. Mm-hmm. So I think
the flavors are kind of compressed. It doesn't seem.
Yeah, you're not getting a lot of different character.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about when you talk about character. You're not getting a lot of different notes.
Yeah, there's not diversity on the palate.
It's like a single note as opposed to a chord.
Yeah. A lot of times when you run into like a really awesome wine, a really like world-class wine, it's almost sort of like overwhelmingly complex and harmonious at the same time. Like you get all these flavors in the right balance, and it's hard to parse what you're tasting, but yeah.
And the second? Childress?
Childress I poured out, and I'm on the third one because I'm supposed to be leading the tasting. And
so, no, I think the second one is a bit harmonious, a bit more. And I think that we were talking about, I think there's some red cherry going on, and I taste a little different things.
Yeah, a little bit more directly fruity. You mentioned earlier that it's slower in alcohol, which I think you can perceive on the palate.
Right, yeah.
So. Yeah, this is a drink today wine. If you bought it today, drink it today. And mm-hmm. it says on the label, three is an excellent choice with spicy fare or on its own. So this is like a barbecue wine. It's probably, you know, some kind of Rhone varietal in there. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Quickly drinkable.
Yeah, drinkable today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The third wine is from the Old North State Winery, which I think is in Mount Airy. And to me, this is the best wine of the three. It's got a little bit more color than the Childress. It's almost the color of the first Cabernet. Smells like a Cabernet Sauvignon.
Which
it's also non-vintage.
And a Cabernet Sauvignon should smell like what?
Like this, I don't know.
that's helpful. I
can't describe. I said my tongue doesn't describe things.
I think a lot of like those descriptors came out of like aristocratic British drinking clubs in like Cambridge and places where people would get blotto and try to like outdo themselves with coming up with like
tobacco. I smell tobacco.
Yeah, and flowery words
cherry
for
saddle leather.
Well, let's talk about your three experiences here. You were, Mark, a neuropsychologist who didn't know very much about wine when you first started it, and I'm told that it was a glass of port after dinner that changed your life.
That's right. So I grew up in a household where we didn't, wine drinking just was not in, you know, what we did. And, I had wine, I drank wine from time to time, maybe wine that I would find at a gas station or something, who knows? And then, I went through school and I became a neuropsychologist and I started, having some better wine, but it wasn't until I actually went to a friend's house and he was having a party and he opened up a bottle of a 1955 Graham's Port. It's like a fortified wine. And it was an epiphany moment for me. I tried it and I realized this was, the most amazing thing I'd ever tasted.
Why?
It's just everything was – every flavor was there. It was all like a symphony and it was all perfect harmony and it's so hard to explain unless you kind of had that moment with a fine bottle of wine, but it's just something that you can recall, a moment you can recall in time that you can kind of like remember what that tastes like and what you were doing and how that came about.
And Jay, I understand that you I left out part of your story. I said that you started collecting wines because you wanted the buy the case discount.
Yeah, that's true.
Then you
true.
Really got into it because you were snowbound and only had one bottle of wine, and you vowed that was never going to happen again.
That was a terrible experience.
But you also report having a meal in Rome that changed your life, and you were only 15. Was the wine included in that meal?
I'm pretty sure I had wine. Yeah.
Kids drink over there.
That's true. No, I have French friends who tell me about drinking like watered down wine when they're 7, 8 years old because it was the beverage they had. I grew up in southern England and I traveled a fair amount in France and Italy when I was a kid. And I just became aware of food cultures that embraced wine as a part of daily life. And I had an amazing carbonara at a restaurant in Rome that just made me aware of the fact that food is more central to some people's lives than it had been to mine up until that point. And that's kind of all it was at that time. But when I was at UNC, we started doing like big dinner parties at my house, and you have a lot of friends come over, you want to get a case discount on your wine. So I started shopping at a really good specialty wine shop in my hometown and in Chapel Hill, and then it all spiraled out of control from there.
Well, we are developing this foodie culture. I remember the first time I had an eye-opening meal was in Italy because they know how to do food and they know how to it's not just the food.
Although no, it's not.
It's the freshness of all the ingredients, but it's also the atmosphere and the laid-back nature of it all. They sit there and they eat for hours. It's wonderful.
Yeah, today we have amazing food here, and I think that the interest in wine in North Carolina comes half out of the restaurant culture of this area. I mean, it's partly proximity to good wine shops that we have today, but when I go back to Italy and I go to buy wine for my company – I do always have that first meal moment where I'm like, oh, yeah, like the food here is better. Like, this food is something special that I can convince myself in my home kitchen that I'm having food as good as I have over there. But really, there is a difference.
So. Wine's not pretentious in Italy.
It's rarely.
Just, it's like having a Coke.
Yeah.
It's always there.
There's
they water it down sometimes.
There's a misunderstanding about, people say, Italians only have wine with food, and Americans imagine that means that Italians have a glass of wine at dinner. No, it just means Italians have food around all the time. They might have some wine at 3 in the afternoon, but it's with food.
Now, Jerry, you are where wine goes off the rails for a lot of people because they might be intimidated by what you're involved in. You are the cellar master for the North Carolina chapter of the Commanderie du Bordeaux, which makes it sound very highfalutin, is it?
Well, there's the first growths of Bordeaux that people have heard of, Petrus and Chateau Mouton Rothschild and a few others, and those sell for $800 to $1,000 a bottle. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, 10 or 12,000 wineries in Bordeaux, and most of them are struggling to sell their wine for $10 to $12 to $15 a bottle, and it doesn't really get here because of the expense. So. Our chapter, the Commanderie de Bordeaux, it's part of an international trade association based in Bordeaux and sponsored by the wine industry. So we're an arm of that, but we're a separate private club chartered in the United States. We're one of 30 chapters. And what we do, we're supposed, I say it like this, that we're supposed to spread the gospel of drinking Bordeaux wine.
What is it about Bordeaux? What is the gospel? What's it based on?
It's been there forever. There's 1,000 years of history. Some of the chateaux are famous in their own right for where they were and where they still are with the flavors of the wine. I was just in California in wine country, and somebody said that, you know, when you drink a glass of California wine, it's like fruit in a glass, and when you taste a Bordeaux wine, it's like terroir in a glass. It's the place. So you can really, if you have the palate, you can really taste the difference between all the different.
That word that has come up a couple of times, terroir, has no literal translation into English.
Well,
so it's hard to describe what it is that you're talking
about. Yeah, I always just use the word place. And I think that it includes the human
territory
being, the place. Territory, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, sun and soil and sweat and
all
nature,
the elements.
So.
You started these auctions, Mark, because you decided early in your wine appreciation days that the best way to afford a fine bottle of wine is to buy them at, this is like buy low, sell high, buy them at bargain basement prices at auction, and then maybe sell a few of the bottles that you buy at a higher price so that you can then go back and afford the higher priced wine.
Well, that was definitely my strategy for a while, and to increase my collection. Buying wine at auction, as Jerry said before, sometimes when you want to buy older vintages, you just can't really, it's harder to do. And so that's a good way to do it. That's a great way to purchase wine. So
I think we all get into the industry for the discount. It's like the reason why you get into this is to afford some for yourself.
What is the markup, by the way? That's a lot.
I work for free.
All right. Chris emails, can your guest comment on, I'm going to say the words, box wines. Have they gotten better over the years?
Had some wonderful box wines.
They're very good for taking to a pool party.
Or
can't have glass.
Actually, I import a few boxed wines, and there are. It's a sound method of closure for 6 to 8 months of shelf storage, and I think it's great for folks who want to have a glass of wine at night and they don't want to open a whole bottle. But there are now. I work with a producer who's certified organic and a scrupulous farmer in the Piedmont of Italy, and they make a nice boxed Barbera. So,
most people would be reluctant to plunk down $50 for a bottle of wine, which has what, 4.5 glasses in it. It would be difficult economically for them, and maybe they could afford it, but they just can't get their head around paying $50 for 4 glasses of wine. I mean, I know that's not everybody, but there are a lot of people out there. What are they missing? Why should they do it? Why should they take the plunge? And if you're going to take that plunge for the first time, where should you put that money? What kind of wine?
So my 2 cents is those same folks might actually go out to a restaurant and spend $7-$8 a glass on wine and get a lesser wine because they're getting something that's at the lower end of the price spectrum. And drinking at home is actually quite economical compared to to having.
Well, actually, you'd be hard pressed to find a $7 bottle, a glass of wine
exactly.
at a restaurant in Charlotte.
A great price point for wine of value and good quality is in the $15 to $20 range, and so. If you know a variety you like, if you like Pinot Noir, that's a little bit harder to get at that price point. But certain wine regions in the world, Spain, Portugal, Italy, at that price point, southern France have excellent wines.
You know, over the history of my knowledge of wine, which is very short and very brief, but it seemed that for a while Cabernets were in, then Merlots were in, and then Pinot Noir was in. They were the things everybody were ordering when you went out to drink a glass of wine or have dinner. Is that my imagination, or does wine go in cycles like that?
It definitely does. And just don't buy what's in because you want to save yourself some money. Like, look for something that's, there's over 3,000 Italian wine grapes alone. Like, you're going to get a better bang for buck if you just shop in the margins of popularity, I think.
And you love Italian wines. What is it about Italian wines that
sells
you
sells them?
It was my first first love. You know, I like the food compatibility of Italian wine. You have a country in Piedmont Wine Imports. We work in 9 of the 20 regions of Italy. Each region has a distinct food culture. The Apennines kept them apart. I mean, you have these intensely regional places that have a lot to say to us.
We have been talking about enjoying fine wine as a beverage. Is fine wine an investment? And if so, is it a good investment?
Well, yes, wine is definitely an investment. And there's some wines from certain years that have outperformed almost any stock on the planet. And if only I could have gone back when the 1982s came out from Bordeaux, that would have been a wise thing to snatch up. But yes, people do definitely drink wine as an investment. We actually have people who come to the auction who do that as opposed to come to the auction to buy wine to drink. It's just, you know, it's just what different people decide to do when they're there.
Red wines are actually supposed to be good for your health. As a matter of fact, my doctor prescribed a glass of red wine a day.
Great.
He said, if you miss a dose, don't catch up. That said, some people prefer white wines, which are not as good for you, medicinally speaking. But red wines seem to pair well with heavier foods and colder temperatures when it's cold outside as opposed to hot outside. Are there good reds to drink at a barbecue or when it's 89 degrees outside?
You know, I even recommend Chillable Reds for summertime in North Carolina. There's plenty of grapes out there, like Cru Beaujolais, Grignolino from the Piedmont of Italy, things you can keep in your fridge door and serve at 50 degrees with barbecue.
Should red wines be served slightly chilled, or should they be served at room temperature?
Well, I've always thought that people serve white wine too cold and red wine too hot. So 65 degrees for a red wine is pretty good. They call that room temperature, but it's room temperature in 1770 in France in a big castle. That's the room temperature.
And we Annette didn't get to this, but should you decant all wines, and for how long? We have 10 seconds.
My wife says yes.
No, I don't think so. I think some wines are just ready to go.
Are those aerating devices any good? Do they work?
They do. I think so.
Okay. Mark Solomon, who is the fine wine director of Leland Little Auctions. The auction is Thursday night, 8 o'clock in Hillsborough. Jerry Doliner, the North Carolina chapter head of the Commanderie de Bordeaux. And Jay Murray with Piedmont Wine Imports.